From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to an In the Moment news podcast special. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the segment podcast. And now, time for this COVID-19 special. South Dakota lawmakers worked into the early morning for a rather unusual veto day. SDPB's Lee Strubinger joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh this morning for an update and recap.
Lee, thanks for returning. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, good to be here, Lori.
Especially after a little bit of a late night. So Lee set up veto day for us. What did lawmakers step into yesterday?
Sure. So just kind of a reminder, the legislature recesses for 2 weeks and reconvenes to consider vetoes that the governor may issue. She issued four this year, but that wasn't really the main point of this convening, if you will. The last week of session was really when the coronavirus started making its presence felt in the state. And even the week before, the governor said that the state was at a low risk of seeing the virus. So let's fast forward to today. And, it's essentially all we're covering. State Representative Bob Glanzer is in critical condition in the hospital. You know, the Argus leader is reporting that his family has drafted up a do not resuscitate order. And yesterday the legislature met digitally. Save for a few legislators, leaders, and members of the more conservative wing of the Republican Party. And they considered 12 bills that looked at helping the state respond to this COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, first, deep concern for Representative Bob Glanzer. I'm mm-hmm. so sorry that his family is going through this thing that all of us, seem to be afraid of right now, and it's come home for them very early. Tell us about what did and didn't pass last night.
Well, so lawmakers voted to postpone elections that are coming up in April and May and postpone them to any Tuesday of June this year, including the primary date of June 2nd. But there's also still concern because the state estimates we'll see a peak number of COVID-19 cases in May. They also stripped minimum instruction hours for the current school year and removed state testing requirements for schools. And they're also enacting a grace period of 90 days for folks whose licenses expire during this pandemic. And they also passed some small business loan programs, carved out some space for additional federal dollars to help the state address this pandemic this fiscal year. And they set up an emergency unemployment fund.
So South Dakota lawmakers are also passing a bill that broadens the governor's power in times of disaster or emergencies. That's meant to define the governor's role in addressing COVID-19 and the outbreak. What will that bill allow the governor to do, and what won't it let her do?
So it eases licensing timelines for licensed professionals. And one of the examples that got brought up is easing licensure for medical professionals, like letting med students, getting them into the healthcare system sooner to help deal with an anticipated influx of patients in our hospital system. It also suspends the letting process for state and local government contracts, which the example was given to allow governments to respond quicker if they need to put out a bid for something. One of the things that Governor Noem will not be able to do is close gun stores or infringe on any gun-related rights. Lawmakers added a provision to that bill that says she will not have the authority to limit the use, sale, and transportation of firearms and ammo. That was supported by Republican Senate President Pro Tem Brock Greenfield, who says the legislature is just trying to be responsive in a time that's chaotic.
There are no boogeymen that were intended, simply trying to ensure that we've addressed a concern put forth by a number of people out there in the public.
And this amendment did draw some concern from some Democratic lawmakers. And, that public that Greenfield mentioned includes the National Rifle Association, which drafted the amendment that House Republicans initially approved. And Representative Spencer Gosch was the one who brought this amendment to the bill.
This is language brought by the National Rifle Association. This is a concern that is happening in the state. This language was added. It was vetted again through the governor's office. They made some of their changes, and that is the language that we have adopted here that you will see.
So to be clear, Lee, does that mean that, that guns and ammunition are considered part of the critical infrastructure industries nationwide, or this is statewide action?
I believe it's they had pointed to gun sales being protected at the federal level, I believe. I'd have to double check that for sure. But yeah. This language makes it clear that in the state of South Dakota, it is something that that gun stores will not be shut down and the sale of
right.
ammo.
Not restricted. Meanwhile, lawmakers rejected a bill that would allow the Secretary of Health to order closure of businesses, parks, schools, other locations that promote public gatherings. Lawmakers insist the governor already has that authority. Is that so?
So I reached out to the governor about that, and a spokesperson for Kristi Noem's office says, you know, the governor has broad emergency powers, but has chosen not to order these statewide business closures. And lawmakers rejected this bill mainly because out of concern that they would be granting this authority to an unelected official, and in this case, the Secretary of Health.
But that was a bill dropped by the governor's office.
Right. And the governor's office says that the House voting to reject the measure is consistent with the governor's reluctance to order business closures, and that's something she's been consistent on since more COVID-19 cases have started appearing in the governor's office. You know, instead, the governor's office says that they're encouraging innovation and local control for businesses across the state.
Aren't many states nationwide who are taking that stance right now? The legislature also rejected a bill that gives counties the same authority to place restrictions on commerce that municipalities have during times of public health emergencies. So therefore, Minnehaha County would have been able to make those decisions for the city of Sioux Falls, for example. So where does that leave counties? Because the legislature rejected that bill.
Right. And they rejected it despite pleas and support from the mayors of Sioux Falls, Rapid City, and the Municipal League, and commissioners from Brown and Minnehaha counties. And one of the things that this bill would have done is it would have shortened the time frame for cities and counties to pass ordinances, and it would have granted them to do that on a single reading. Currently, they require two readings with 5 days in between. And some mayors and county commissioners say that the time between ordinances remains too long. And one of those folks was Rapid City Mayor Steve Allender, who says the COVID-19 pandemic is constantly evolving and governments need to be able to react quickly.
This is the fastest moving scenario I have ever witnessed in my life. So requiring a 5-day wait between the reading of ordinances is 5 days too long and can easily constitute a threat under these circumstances.
During Sioux Falls Mayor Paul Ten Haken's press briefing this morning, he also expressed his frustration at the legislature voting this bill down.
Yesterday, our legislature had the chance to equip local government to respond to the pandemic on a local level. And unfortunately, they chose not to let us lead on the local level and take the actions we need to take in our community. And so in some ways, I feel like we are bringing a knife to a gunfight a little bit. We're being asked to lead on the local level, but without the full authority we need to lead. So we're in a very challenging spot. I want everybody to be very clear on that and know that we are leading on the local level as best we can based on the laws that have been given to us to operate with under.
And I asked Governor Noem about that this morning. She held a press conference a little while ago, and you know, Governor Noem says that her office helped draft the bill, and you know, but ultimately lawmakers decided to vote this down.
The legislature at the end of the day decided not to pass that bill. We brought it forward and worked with them on it and were helpful in answering questions throughout the process, but at the end of the day, they did not pass the legislation.
And while lawmakers were debating this bill, there were portions of the bill that the governor's office did not support. And one of those was the shortened time frame mentioned earlier for passing city ordinances. Matt McCauley is a Sioux Falls lawyer and a lobbyist for the governor's office. You know, he says the guidance local governments want are in her executive order that she issued a little while ago.
The governor believes, and as an issue by the executive order, there should be conversations going on at the local level and not business closures.
So what we're seeing right now is a further unfolding of tensions between some local governments and state government. You know, in lieu of NOME issuing a statewide closure of business, local governments want some kind of backing from the state, some teeth behind their decisions to close businesses.
So what happens here is that those local lawmakers, those county commissioners and small town mayors, and then mayors like Allender and Tenhaken, are getting tremendous pressure from businesses because it's your livelihood at stake. Mm-hmm. What do you hear kind of bubbling up from the surface about how tense this really is and how much of who has the authority, whose time is it to take leadership? Mayor Tenhaken in his press conference today was right out there saying, you know, I'm balancing public health with what I can legally do and what the legal consequences would be for me taking some of the actions that I want to take. Mayors and county commissioners are really in a bind.
Mm-hmm. So the cities of Huron, Yankton, and Rapid City have all ordered these ordered closures. Yeah. And Sioux Falls, I think Tenhaken has said that Sioux Falls has gone up to the 1 yard line. And what Tenhaken said today also in his press conference was that he was going to be meeting with the Municipal League of South Dakota and other tier one mayors to put forward to discuss maybe draft ordinance that other cities across the state can sort of look at, because, you know, Tenhaken is saying that he has cities reaching out to him about how they're handling this and what they're putting forward. So, you know, and Governor Noem has been very reluctant to issue a statewide closure on business. You know, she says that a closure in Sioux Falls and Rapid City, you know, might work for those municipalities, but they might not work for places like Faith or Lemon. So definitely we'll see it unfold over time, I guess.
How long did they discuss last night? Late night.
It was a very late night. I think they went until about 3:30 Central. So
in the morning. To clarify for people.
In the morning. This morning.
What are they done now? Or is there any thought of a special session? Is this it? This was their last opportunity. We got about 30 seconds for that.
Yeah, technically they're sign and die right now, which means that they are done with this legislative session for now. There are talks about whether or not there does need to be a special session to rework the fiscal year 2021 budget. But also the time frame in which they'd have to do that is when the state is expecting peak cases of COVID-19. So, you know, there's still a lot out there that state lawmakers still may be asked to decide on and rule on.
Wow.
Yeah.
Lee Strubinger,
going forward.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, of course, Lori. Thanks.
Now, SDPB has been welcoming your questions about coronavirus and the disease it causes, COVID-19. You can text those questions to 605-956-SDPB. Dr. Wendell Hoffman, he's the infectious disease specialist at Sanford Health, returned to the program to give us an update and answer some of the questions we've gathered so far.
Welcome back. Thanks, Dr. Hoffman, for being here.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
All right. Let's start with, what do we know about this virus that we didn't know even a week ago? How fast are we learning about this thing, and what are we learning?
You know, I think the analogy I would use is that we all feel like we're drinking from a fire hose. This is just, if you take two steps back, this is just extraordinarily fascinating, but at the same time, very, very sobering. Mm-hmm. And part of the challenge is that while we are in a pandemic, this is not an influenza pandemic. Okay, so when we track back, influenza pandemics going back, the last 10 over the last 250 years or so, we have accumulated a lot of information about the influenza group of viruses. We kind of have much more solid predictive models that can help us, like, for instance, in the 2009 pandemic H1N1, and in other pandemics before, the four major pandemics in the 20th century plus this one now in the 21st century. And now we're dealing with the second pandemic of the 21st century. But the fundamental difference is that coronavirus is a different class of viruses, and that is why it is so utterly frustrating for the public and also for those of us who are caring for these patients and trying to give guidance to predict where it's headed. So what do we know now that we didn't know a week ago? Well, you know, some things we do. I think we have a much greater respect for how easily this this virus is being transmitted, and why, for instance, it can sort of spread in a region kind of under the radar and then suddenly begin to pop up and then explode. I think we are. That's why we're seeing all of these kind of uses of terms like hotspots and. So I would say this is an evolving situation with rapid learning, and we're trying to apply the very best science that we have, not just from the United States, but from around the world.
Are you making predictions and guesses on whether or not, you know, Governor Kristi Noem said, here's my specific question. Governor Kristi Noem said in a recent press conference that the stay-at-home measures that we're taking are working. And the big question was, is it too soon to tell that? Do we know that it's working? Do you feel like the stay-at-home measures are currently effective?
So I think the answer to that is, it's difficult to make a categorical yes to any question with this virus, but I do strongly believe that the measures that have been put in place are being effective. And I think the way you know that is to consider this in terms of two-week blocks. You know, we've heard about the famous incubation period, which is thought to be at this point around 14 days. And so if you think about it in two-week blocks, therefore, what we're seeing now, we can say in South Dakota, is what was happening 2 weeks ago. What we will see 2 weeks from now is a result of what we're doing now. And so that's why we're seeing this in two-week. You know, we kind of like to talk in two-week blocks. And that's why it's so important why our leaders in this state have really, I think, done an extraordinary job. They have got a tough, they have to balance so many different things, both from the medical side and from the economic side. I really am grateful for what they have done, kind of cool, calm, and collected, competent as they are receiving information and trying to apply as non-medical people. So, I do endorse what we're doing. And we will see the results, I think, reflected over the next several weeks. And all of us are hoping and expecting that the numbers of cases are going to come down, even in regions like South Dakota, states like South Dakota, where as of yesterday, we were still under 100 cases.
Right. All right. So here are some of the questions we're getting from listeners. And one of the big ones I hear again and again and again is keeping yourself safe inside your house, you know, once you're there. Getting groceries into the house, whether it's safe to take to order takeout. So let's start with takeout from a restaurant. Is that safe to do, and what's the safest way to do it?
So I think it is. I think it is safe. There's no evidence, for instance, that this virus is transmitted in food or water. I mean, you have to think about it in terms of the environmental. The evidence for environmental contamination is significant. And is sobering, and I think is part of the reason why the virus has spread so easily. But there's clearly, I'm not aware of any evidence, as I sit here, that getting food from takeouts is places one at increased risk, or going to grocery stores. The thing at the grocery stores, you know, like any place where people congregate, would be the direct being in direct proximity to a person who may be asymptomatically shedding the virus or who may have mild symptoms and is not even aware themselves. Maybe they have a little stuffy nose or a runny nose, because this virus kind of has the whole spectrum of symptoms. So I would not be afraid to go to the grocery store. I would not be afraid, you know, to go get food takeout. I mean, my wife and I went and got food last night that we took out, and we're trying to support our favorite businesses too, which is the other half of this equation. So no, I would not be concerned about that kind of activity. As far as, you know, what one does in the home, I think I'll just tell you what my wife and I do. When I come home, I try to, you know, maintain, as tough as it is for me. Not sure it's that tough for her, but but we try to maintain some sense of distance. Yeah. We try to clean off the non-porous surfaces where I think most of the evidence lies in terms of environmental contamination. So the hard surfaces in your home, I think to periodically wipe them down with common disinfectants, because it looks like this particular class of viruses, you know, it's kind of wimpy. I can use that word. These are enveloped RNA viruses that are very susceptible to just, you know, denaturing by even being out in the air. I mean, they start to degrade immediately, and yet they can persist. I mean, some of these studies, which are experimental, right? They're in a laboratory. That doesn't necessarily mean that translate into contagious virus, but it does mean that we have to respect it. And so in the home, maintain some sort of a distance. In our situation, because I'm a healthcare provider and my risk is maybe a little bit higher than the general public's, my wife and I sleep in different bedrooms. It's just a simple thing that we can do. We use a separate bathrooms, but that's me. I mean, and I'm just trying to protect her as much as I can. And of course she says, well, how do you know that you're not going to get it from me? Because she's out and about in the community too. And the answer is, I don't. So that kind of goes to the other thing. And I think we have to respect this virus, but we cannot fear it in that sense. We cannot dread it. We have to do reasonable things that will allow our lives to move forward. Because if we overreact, then the virus has already won without even infecting us. So we have to differentiate between respect and dread. And I think we're definitely going to get through this. But for those who are in their homes and sheltering in place, particularly those people who are at increased risk for the complications of COVID-19, and the elderly, I fully believe we're going to come through this, not without some pain, clearly, and one has to tip your cap and just salute the healthcare workers all over the nation, particularly in these very difficult circumstances that places like New York State are facing.
Right. So takeout and grocery store, when you bring anything into your house, from the things that you might purchase in the community that which are your necessities, do you disinfect them when you come in, wipe them down? Does that make a difference, or are we doing that to make ourselves feel better?
I think it's probably more the latter. I mean, I've not seen any of that from CDC. I think it's in your space with countertops and surfaces, your environment that are exposed to you, mm-hmm. not the stuff that you necessarily bring in, but it's in your space because you're in the space. Your family is in the space, you know. For instance, and also, you know, there's one study that came out of China where they looked at, it was a really interesting, detailed epidemiologic look at how this virus seemed to spread to secondary contacts. And what we learned from that study, now out probably, I don't know, 3-4 weeks ago already, which just goes to tell you how quickly this is evolving, because this kind of seems like one big long day, but what that study showed was that the attack rate in households was about 15%, and it that study also indicated, and this was our first glimpse into the more complex question of the role that children have in our communities, you know, with COVID, thankfully, that they are rarely or unusually affected in a serious way. We don't know about whether or not they can be vectors. But the point being, I'll go back to that: in your home, if you're sheltering in place with several individuals, you can still be successful in trying to prevent this. You don't have to just kind of throw up your hands and say, well, there's nothing I can do. No, that's not true. There are things you can do in your home. It's the same stuff. It's maintaining some distance, because we know also that you have to be in the presence of somebody who's infected for a longer than just, you know, like a walking by, you know. So we don't have to treat each other as the enemy. We have to treat the virus as the enemy, but we also have to recognize that you have to be within that 6-foot parameter for more than just, you know, a short period of time, it would appear. And so within the home, yeah, social distancing, as you can practice it, it's tough because you got little kids, no doubt, and you got grandpas and grandmas, and you're all trying to do the best thing possible as we move forward. And then cleaning environmental surfaces, the social distancing, and washing your hands. Can't emphasize that enough. Try to avoid going to your mouth and nose. It's tough. I can't do it very well. But I think I'm getting better at it than I was even a week ago. And just to be mindful of those things, I think, are the three big things. And then don't focus so much on what you're bringing into the home. Focus on what's going on in the home.
All right. In our remaining minute, one of our other listener questions is, what does recovered mean in this context? When we get the numbers from the Department of Health and it says there's 34 people recovered, those are the numbers from Saturday right now. What does that mean in the last 30 seconds or so that we have?
Great question. So what technically what recovered means is likely that they now test negative. That's probably what it means. But clinically recovered, though, the Chinese data suggests that in somebody who's severely ill or who has to be in the hospital, it may take up to a month before they're really feeling back on their feet, and even longer if they've been really, really critically ill. So the story on that is yet pending, but those are the general definitions of what recovered means.
Dr. Wendell Hoffman, we appreciate your time very much. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time. Be well.
You're very welcome, and everybody out there, be well, be encouraged, be hopeful. We're going to do this.
And with that, shortages of personal protective equipment have been occurring all over the nation. And as the COVID-19 cases continue to increase, more and more masks and gloves will be needed for our healthcare workers to protect themselves as they care for their patients. While students at the Sanford School of Medicine may not be able to be in the hospitals, but that doesn't mean they're not still trying to help. Today we welcomed a couple of med students who are conducting a PPE drive. Let's take a listen.
Today, we're joined by two students organizing a personal protective equipment drive. Anna Buntrock is a third-year med student planning on specializing in OBGYN, and Natalie Walter is a third-year med student specializing in emergency medicine. Anna, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Lori. I'm excited to talk to you guys about what we have planned.
Natalie, thanks for being here as well.
Yes, thank you so much. We are really excited about this opportunity to help others and hopefully spread the word.
All right, let's talk about what you're doing first, and then I do want to talk a little bit about how this has sort of changed your own trajectory. But first, in the interest of being of service to others, Anna, let's start with you. What exactly is the need, and how are you trying to meet it?
So I'm sure many people have seen on the news all across the nation, there's shortages of masks and gloves and gowns for the doctors and the nurses and other hospital staff. In light of the increasing number of cases in South Dakota here, we're trying to be a little proactive and collect some of this protective equipment from people that they may have at their homes or at their local businesses.
And how is that coordinating? How are you able to get that word out to people? Natalie, you go ahead.
Yeah.
So we are reaching out to several of local businesses, salon parlors, different local schools such as Augustana, and getting different donations such as gloves and masks. Great cause. For us, we're also doing a drive so we will be located at four different locations across Sioux Falls from 4 to 6 p.m. every night this week. Those locations are the zoo, the downtown public library, the Walmart South on Minnesota, and the, I'm missing one.
Avera Fitness Center on the east side of town.
All right. And those are all in parking lots. So you're not going into any, you know, you're not asking people to gather. You're asking people to drop those off with a proper distancing behavior. Tell me a little bit about this is something that people had. You know, are people showing up and saying that they had things that they were willing to give?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yesterday was our first day of the drive, and we had four medical students posted throughout the town at those locations. And we had people come that have woodworking businesses or have, or like to paint. And so they've had these masks at home that they've just collected throughout the years. And we found quite a few boxes of them and boxes of gloves from other people. It's actually been a pretty good turnout so far. I'm hoping the rest of the week looks as good.
All right. I want to talk a little bit about what's happening to you folks. And Natalie, let's start with you, because third year med student thinking about emergency medicine, it must be kind of hard for you to feel like you're not, you know, you're not in the ER right now, because what a learning opportunity.
Definitely. As many of us are struggling with not being able to be physically present, they're helping patients, as that is what we have loved to do for the past year. We've been in the clinic, so now we're kind of having to remove ourselves in order to help protect the community as a whole. I found it very helpful when I talked to other physicians about this, and that they are telling us that we have to think about the future. We have to think about protecting the future of medicine. So although right now we're not actively involved, we will be in the future.
I'm going to let that sink in for a minute for people, because the future of medicine and protecting it does also imply that it's possible we could lose a lot of our healthcare providers in this pandemic. And that's a sobering thought indeed. And heightens the need for this personal protective gear. We did not want those people getting sick. Anna, how is your medical school journey been sort of upended by this?
I think for a lot of people, a lot of my classmates that have more surgery-heavy fields of medicine that they're interested in, a lot of the elective surgeries have been canceled at the hospitals. For OBGYN, that's obstetrics and gynecology, a lot of the different inductions for labor have been canceled. And so it is different for us, but I think we're still doing the best we can to help out the doctors and our teachers who are still on the front lines helping the patients of our community.
What's your message, Anna, for people who are still struggling with some of the restrictions that are in place and trying to figure out how to adjust life at home, or maybe not so sure that all this is necessary? What do you want to say to them?
I would like to just say that if you're not concerned as much about yourself, make sure we think about the other people that may be more at risk for this illness. People that are immunocompromised or have some other illness that puts them at increased risk. And so just adjusting our lives at home is going to allow us to hopefully kind of slow down the spread of the virus and then eventually get us all back to our lives once again.
Now, we've all been watching the devastating economic impact of the pandemic disruption, but South Dakotans want to know what's happening here at home. And so we invited on Joe Santos. He's a professor of economics at SDSU. Let's take a listen.
Hey, Joe, welcome back.
Hi, Lori. Thank you.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling very well, thank
good,
you. And you?
Good. Every day that we're feeling well is a good day, right?
That's a good day. That's exactly right.
And yet there are things that we're not feeling so great about, including the economy right now. And I joke ruefully about that. Obviously, it's not funny. Mm-hmm. But how big is this stimulus package that we're looking at? Let's talk about the big picture first and then break it down to what it looks like in South Dakota and why that matters.
Sure. So the stimulus package is, I'm sure everyone has heard this, $2 trillion number. So that's mm-hmm. roughly the amount of the stimulus that the package will allow. This is probably not the last stimulus package we're going to see. In fact, the way that most, I think, in Congress are thinking about this right now is there seem to be distinguishing between what they call stabilization and stimulus. And what they've done at this point to this point is really stabilization. They're trying to engineer a slow, gradual decline in economic activity, if at all possible. And they have determined that at this moment, roughly 10% of GDP, that's what $2 trillion is versus, say, a $20 trillion economy, is perhaps what we need for probably the next 4 to 8 weeks. So if this were to drag on beyond 2 months, I think it's the general consensus at this point that, again, there'd have to be an additional package. Hopefully at that point, we would be stimulating the economy, that is trying to essentially jumpstart it, since what we have essentially done now is shut it down, and not additional stabilization. But of course, we don't know how that's going to play out exactly. I should say, this is very much sort of uncharted water for policymakers all over the planet. This is, and you know, in textbooks and macroeconomics, we often talk about what we call an exogenous shock, something coming from outside the system that buffets the economy, and then the economy sort of deals with it, and policymakers deal with the economy. This is the textbook definition. I mean, it's epidemiological in nature. It's not a crash of the financial crisis. It's not some sort of problem in the banking system. It is very much from outside the economy. And so policymakers are dealing with something that they have not really had to deal with before. And so we're using the term unprecedented a lot, but it really, I think, is appropriate in this case.
Here's my question about that. And when we talk about hospitals have planned for pandemics and governments have planned for pandemics, were there, I mean, was this a matter of imagination? Were there any models that were run? What if scenarios, researchers, macroeconomic researchers saying, what if this happened? Is this completely, are we starting from scratch, or is there some kind of, you know, we knew this was possible scenario?
Sure. That's a really good question. Folks have performed some studies. There's a Congressional Budget Office study that apparently was done. I wasn't aware of it at the time. It was 2005, who was thinking about policy responses to pandemics. But as I understand it, that's been sort of dusted off.
Right.
And folks are looking at some of the numbers there. The estimates right now are quite dramatic. So there's a little bit of sort of bad news, good news, but remind me to get back to the good news. But last week, we saw that the number of individuals filing for unemployment claims jumped to about 3.2 million. Now, just some context, throughout the months leading up to March, the number was always like a 200, 300,000-ish number. It went to 3.2 million. So that is an enormous jump in jobless claims. We have to expect that we're going to see those claims sort of work themselves through the real economy and turn into actual unemployment statistics and the sort of commensurate declines in economic output. So the economists are talking about things like 10 or 12% reduction in GDP next quarter. That's enormous as a decline in economic output. But again, if we look around, television photos, images of main streets and so on, it's not hard to understand how that number, how we arrive at that number. We are trying, for epidemiological reasons, of course, but essentially trying to shut down social engagement. which is the sort of medium for economic activity. So while it's not our intention, of course, we are essentially intentionally shutting down the economy. And this is a little bit like rebooting, you know, that computer where you're always worried, will it actually restart? We've never shut it down and attempted to restart it. But of course, the longer it is shut down, the more economic loss we will endure. So these numbers, the projections of economic loss, are very, very large. Again, the order of 10%, not say 1% per quarter on an annualized basis. That's a very large decline in economic activity. Similarly, we have estimates, again, based on the jobless claims for unemployment insurance, that the labor market will similarly deteriorate rather dramatically. So all of this is very sudden and very pronounced in terms of economic losses. I should say, though, the good news.
The good news, please.
I think it's important to keep in mind. Again, this is an epidemiological shock. This is not a fraying of the financial system. This isn't a fundamental breakdown in our rule of law, in the way we govern ourselves, and so on. I think about this in terms of, let's say, baking. We still have all of the ingredients. Mm-hmm. Some of the ingredients are susceptible to virus, so we need to contain our activity in the way we're containing it. But we still have labor. We still have capital. We have entrepreneurial spirit. So we have all of the ingredients. And of course, we still have the recipes. We haven't forgotten how to build a 737, right?
Right.
We haven't forgotten how to concoct penicillin. I mean, you can go on and on and on. We haven't, mm-hmm. Lost indoor plumbing. All of these innovations, the ingredients, the recipes, including the rule of law, the motivation for innovation, property rights, independent court systems, these are all still in place. But we hit the kill switch, again, for reasons that had only indirectly to do with the economy. And so presumably when we turn that back on, we would expect that individuals could interact with capital again. They can dream. They can innovate. They can rely on a court system. They can rely on, bankruptcy codes and so on. Mm-hmm. The sorts of things, patent protections that will, again, spur innovation and economic activity. So the fact that this is an epidemiological shock is on the one hand perhaps terrifying, kind of horror movie-esque, but it also means that the economic system in which we operate is intact. There are comparisons to the Great Depression in terms of the scale and so on, and I don't know that that will bear itself out. But I will say one way in which this is not like the Great Depression is that at the moment, we're not questioning the viability of free enterprise capitalism. This is not a moment where we have sort of given up on the economic system. We have deliberately stalled it. There's a fundamental difference with, say, the 1920s and 30s and 40s and the alternative systems of governance that erupted during that period. This is not a sort of philosophical questioning of our economic system. It's the realization that we simply can't interact because we'll infect each other. That's a fundamental difference that I think is important to keep in mind.
That makes me feel a lot better, actually, too. It's one of those things where, like when somebody has a rare disease, you say, this is so fascinating if it's not happening to you. So it's really, from a textbook standpoint, won't this be fascinating 100 years to look back and see what we did? And I really wish we didn't have to live through it figure it out as we go. Let's talk about the state of South Dakota, because you say in this school.blog.com piece, all economics is local.
Yeah. So I thought it would be interesting to weave this in a bit. I don't want to make too much of it. But, macroeconomists and Morning Macro, as a result, has spent a lot of time thinking about talking about the general features of the macroeconomy. Right. This is what our folks who tune in hear about all the time. It's the unemployment rate. It's gross domestic product, it's income. You're never getting too granular. You're not specifying what a particular industry is experiencing, or in the case of this blog post, what a particular state is experiencing. Nevertheless, there is a significant amount of variation of economic diversity in the country, of course. And here I mean diversity. We can talk about this in many contexts. Here I'm referring to simply the fact that each of the 50 states tends to experience an economic downturn and an expansion from a downturn, just the business cycle in general, in its own way. And I think that's something to consider, particularly when we talk about policy responses to economic crises, and in particular, this economic crisis. So if states do not all experience increases in unemployment the same way, or decreases during the expansion, and so on and so forth, then it would seem reasonable that economic policy should also be directed in ways that sort of reflect the uniqueness of the states, right? So, you know, if we look at the last recession, we've talked a lot about it, and the expansion thereafter, you know, the state of South Dakota did not experience that in quite the same way the national economy did, certainly didn't experience it the way Michigan did, in which case, you know, the state of Michigan suffered losses that were greater than the nation as a whole and greater than South Dakota as an individual state. So likewise, it's reasonable, I think, to presume that this economic downturn, we will have it, will also affect states differently. And, you know, you're hearing some folks in different states, governors and governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, for example, and I'm not taking a position one way or the other here, but, you know, arguing that the current stimulus package is not sensitive to the unique challenges that the state of New York is experiencing right now. So the punchline then is it probably makes sense to think maybe more about fiscal policy. I know we've been on this rant now for a couple of episodes, fiscal policy than monetary policy, because fiscal policy, generally speaking, can be a bit more granular. You can augment unemployment insurance for workers based on each state's unemployment conditions. You know, monetary policy at the very conventional level, you lower interest rates. That's a sort of shotgun blast.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily address the concerns of one state or another. So, yeah, I think it's important to recognize that while of course it makes sense to study the general features of the economy, the Great Depression told us we should do that, go up to 50,000 feet and look down. We should also be mindful of the fact that no two states will experience the business cycle in precisely the same way. And so if we are interested in implementing policy to address economic contractions, let's say, the policy should address the uniqueness of each state's circumstance.
Give me some examples of what's unique in South Dakota that needs to be addressed.
Sure. So, you know, I don't know how this will play out in
right.
South Dakota, but it's possible, for example, perhaps if the healthcare system is stressed, or I suspect the state budgetary position is compromised because of the need to not only support healthcare, but to perhaps to support education for various sorts of sick leave and unemployment insurance. Depending on what the sort of features of those stresses look like, it may make sense, for example, for the stimulus bill, and the current one does this to some extent, and I just argue we should continue to do this sort of thing, to focus on those state-specific challenges and perhaps backfill budgets accordingly. And again, the $2 trillion does a bit of this. Whether or not it's sufficiently sensitive to the economic situation the state experiences is another matter. You know, how the virus and its effects on the economy affects agricultural commodity prices. And again, I don't have a forecast to share. I'd be lying if I said I did. But those are the sorts of, say, unique circumstances in a agricultural economy like South Dakota's that will differ dramatically than, I don't know, perhaps the economic consequences and so needs of Connecticut. And so, again, this is where I think a more discriminating policy approach may make a bit more sense. And I should say this, you know, this wasn't sort of me dreaming this up for the blog, though there's a bit of that goes on. But this is a growing movement in macroeconomics. I mean, to be fair, macroeconomists have always been aware, of course, that they're sort of averaging over the state activity. But more recently, there's an increasing sort of chorus of voices saying, again, and particularly in the context of fiscal policy and support to households in particular, that probably should be more state dependent than it currently tends to be, or at least be thought of as more state dependent than we tend to think of it.
Lawmakers are convening today for veto day, and one of the tasks at hand is to really look at the state budget. Are revenues, state revenues, part of that that stimulus package or that stabilization package that, that Congress passed? Is there, what happens to the state budget? Because there are a whole lot of services that are dependent upon it.
Yeah, that's right. And so there is, again, the numbers all become blurry, I know, but right. I believe it's about $100 billion of the 2-point-something trillion for state government. So this is the idea is that this will, in effect, backfill the budgetary positions of the states in order, you know, to fill these voids that you've just discussed in, say, the context of South Dakota, but these voids that we expect to see throughout throughout the country. So again, that's a sort of textbook example, I think, of the approach we need to be thinking about. That is, generally speaking, fiscal policy that can be rather precise in the way it is implemented. And I suspect we'll see more precision in what I suspect will be a fourth stimulus bill, perhaps sometime in April. This bill was passed rather quickly, and it's anyone's guess as to exactly how it will sort of play out and be implemented and what its effects will be. I think some folks who have, you know, spoken on the crafting of it have admitted that, you know, this was obviously done in over a very short period of time, and that the next one perhaps could be more precise and more state specific and so on. But yes, there is a wedge, if you will, in the pie of the $2 trillion in this package that is directed to support states. Again, though, whether it's enough for each state in each state circumstance, I'm thinking right now, we'll say Louisiana, in the case of just how the virus seems to be affecting that state, and perhaps Michigan because of Detroit and so on, is just, we're seeing things evolve there. We may have to redirect. But there was a lot of monetary policy talk last week as well, all sorts of interesting new operations. And again, I'm just drawing the contrast that though that is entirely effective, there really is no counterpart to monetary policy, the counterpart to this sort of precision that fiscal policy could afford.
So yes, COVID-19 has us rethinking how we work. It also has us rethinking about access to medical services. And we're also hearing questions from listeners about a variety of legal questions as well. So we brought on Neil Fulton. He's the Dean of the School of Law at the University of South Dakota to help us unpack some of these questions.
Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity, Lori.
I want to start, we've got lots of people wondering about specific things, but I want to start with you, if you would, about the judicial state of emergency that Chief Justice of South Dakota Supreme Court, David Gilbertson, declared. How does that impact us on our daily living?
It kind of depends on where you are, how it's affecting you. The Supreme Court has authority under their rules to declare a judicial emergency if an emergency or natural disaster substantially endangers or infringes upon normal judicial function. So what the Chief Justice did was proclaim the judicial emergency, which allows the Supreme Court to relax certain deadlines and filing rules, and then delegated to each of the presiding judges of the 7 various circuits across South Dakota that they implement a local rule addressing how court would operate, because, you know, how this is going to affect somebody in Sioux Falls or Rapid City may be very different from someone in a smaller community. And some communities are seeing the impact to a much greater degree.
All right. So listeners have questions about, you know, the things that were already in process. So you're in the middle of a divorce. You're in the middle of a custody dispute. You have a court case coming up. All kinds of things. What are some of the fundamentals that is everything on pause? Do things go forward depending on what they are?
So what the state courts are trying to do is keep everything moving forward as best they can, realizing that you have to prioritize. So the Supreme Court and most of the circuits have prioritized first and foremost criminal cases where defendants are in custody. If you are charged with a criminal case, you have a statutory and constitutional right to be tried in a speedy fashion. And for those folks who are detained pretrial, it's a very real issue because you are sitting in jail. So those are prioritized. Other things like civil matters, which are obviously important but don't have quite the same level of pressure, are being prioritized by the local courts, and in a lot of instances are being handled creatively through phone and video conferencing so that people can move their matters forward but that everyone can be safe and not exposed. One thing that the court has done, though, is provide that anyone who's impacted by COVID is able to obtain a continuance from the court. So, for example, if you're self-quarantined or exposed or sick, the court is allowing folks to make sure that they're not prejudiced by the fact that they've been exposed to the virus.
Even if they are not able to get a test?
You know, the orders don't specifically address that, I guess. So, like anything else in the law, right, we sort out the facts. And if we found out that someone had requested a COVID extension but actually wasn't sick, that probably wouldn't go so well. But obviously you're going to have healthcare providers and people caring for people around them who might not themselves be exposed but might not be able to move a judicial matter forward in the same way they could before.
Right. People are asking us about things like custody orders. So in an isolation or a, you know, stay-at-home order or a shelter-in-place or a quarantine, however you're sort of defining those slightly different things, kids go back and forth to different families, and some people want that to stop. And often the person who is not getting to see the child doesn't want it to stop. How should people mm-hmm. think about things like custody orders?
Well, you know, under South Dakota law, the standard for anything custody related is the best interest of the children. And really, I think that's the first place anyone should start with a custody matter, is what's best for the child. Our rules and then procedures for custody cases typically require that parents consult with each other before they go to the court for an order. So, you know, if you're in a shared custody situation, those folks should consult with each other and make a determination whether the child should in fact stay with one of the parents for an extended period right now to avoid exposure or transmission or those types of things. A lot of states are wrestling with this, and you know, again, this is really uncharted territory for everyone. So what happens when you have the parents that just refuse to sort this out, and one of them asserts that the child must or must not move? We just don't know the answer to that yet. But really, if I could give advice to someone, it would be to step back and say what's in the child's best interests for health and safety, because that's what the court's going to eventually look at too.
Right. Will there be consequences for that if one parent maybe doesn't take it seriously and says this is a, you know, I don't believe this is that big of a deal, and the other parent is following CDC guidelines? Is it possible that there are consequences for decisions that are made down the road?
You know, there could be. Once custody orders are in place, usually you need change circumstances to adjust them. If custody is being determined, could that be a factor that the parent didn't make appropriate decisions about the safety of a child? Sure, that could enter into the judge's equation. Again, you know, in this larger balance of what's in the best interest of the child, and with the presumption in South Dakota that in custody settings there is shared custody with a reasonably proximate to 50-50 division in most settings.
Right. This is a grim topic in some ways and a perfectly reasonable one, though, and that's that people are thinking about updating their wills, or they haven't done a will,
yeah,
or they're trying to figure out how to do that. They might normally contact an attorney and ask them for guidance. What do you think? How do people begin if they need to make a change or if they've never done one before?
Yeah, I mean, it's always good to have a will to address your property, and particularly if you have young children. My wife and I do, and that's what drove us to do a will, is not so much concern for our property, but concern for placement of our children. And a lot of lawyers out there are closing their offices, but are still doing business remotely. And in a lot of instances, they should be able to make arrangements to get wills completed and signed, even with social distancing protocols. You know, the number of people you need in a room to sign a will is less than 10. And typically, you'll be able to do that in a way that's safe. The other thing is, if someone is in a position that they just can't go out into the community, the law does recognize what's called a holographic will, meaning a will written out in your own hand. So if someone is just not in a position to get out and have a will formally prepared, they can sit down with a sheet of paper and write out in longhand and sign at the end their intentions about their property and their children.
What are the ways to do that? Are there things that you need to know before you take that step? I mean, I guess what I'm really wondering, is it just a guideline? Is it like, you know, I would like my, you know, all my property to go to my kids, or I want my kids to stay with their grandparents and that's enough? Or is you hit the big things, or are there traps that you might fall into?
You know, generally with a holographic will, the court tries to resolve it in a way that effectuates that person's intent. So the thing is just try and be as clear as you can, right? So, for example, I'll use my wife and I as an example. We pass all of our property to our children if we're both gone, and we make a designation about family members, and we've got, you know, a couple in there in case something's happened to them who would take our children. And so I think you just want to be as clear as you can and as simple as you can. Most of us really just don't have property at such a level that we have to worry about it very much, and we're going to give it to one or two people. So just be clear about that. And then in terms of what you want to happen with your kids, just be as clear and succinct as you can with that.
Yeah. For people who are thinking about their resuscitation orders, or their do not resuscitate, their power of attorney, their, you know, medical powers of attorneys, one of the questions that we had was, you know, you might have an older person who has a do not resuscitate order and who doesn't want to use resources. And now they're living alone. If they have to call 911, they might not be able to communicate those wishes. How does this all change when people can't really be in the room with their loved ones in many cases because of the, you know, contagiousness of this disease?
So in those instances, I think what you really want to do is make sure that the people who are going to be decision makers know where those living wills are and have access to them. And if those are in place and signed, you know, they can be transmitted electronically. So I'd make sure that your children knew where those things were, that your spouse knew where those things were. If you have a primary healthcare provider, that they have a copy of it and are aware of it when it's out there. It's more complicated for someone to give, you know, handwritten directions on that, because obviously the providers are going to err on the side of providing sustaining treatment. But I think the big thing would be, if you have a living will in place, make sure that you have shared it with the people who are going to be asked about what your intentions were if you're not able to express them yourself.
Hmm. Protection orders. We had a listener question about going to get a protection order and not being able to get one. Is that fairly common? Is that, you know what I'm asking? Was that a case-by-case situation where they said, no, we're not going to issue a protection order? Or is there a sort of a blanket, we're just not doing that right now?
You know, that's probably going to be on a case-by-case basis. Whether they're able to conduct a hearing is going to be a real issue. And I know some states, more than South Dakota, are wrestling with exactly this situation, because people are dealing with shelter in place, more restrictive directions from state and local governments in some other states. You definitely have situations where people are now confined in situations that may be abusive or dangerous. And so it's going to be case by case here from everything I've seen.
Yeah. What's your advice to some of these law students? You know, I'm thinking about the students who are, you know, getting ready to graduate, or who are on a path that has now been interrupted. What are some of the challenges facing young attorneys in South Dakota? Because it's always such a challenge to keep them here and put them to work in South Dakota anyway, to get people in that pipeline. What sort of impact do you think we might see in the future?
You know, we're certainly going to see some disruptions of working through graduation here, working through the application process for incoming students. The law school admission test in March was canceled. The Law School Admission Council is working on ways to make that available in April and May in ways that allow social distancing. What I would tell our students, and in fact, did tell our students this morning because I'm trying to email the law students every day and give them updates, is there are really three things for us right now. The first is the most important thing remains providing them with a great legal education and them becoming the best young lawyers that they can be in a situation that's challenging. The second thing is this is a really difficult time for all of us, and it's necessary that we respond as a society with largeness of spirit, with patience and concern for the people around us. And I think that that is something that we as lawyers do as leaders in our society. And I told the law students, this is your opportunity to step forward and lead with largeness of spirit and be an example for people around you. And the last thing is a reminder of why we are doing these things. It gets very easy to get focused on the disruption of our class delivery, of our life and all those things, but we're doing this in order to save lives. The advice from the best medical professionals is we need to do these things to keep people around us safe, for our friends who are immunocompromised, for our parents who are at an age where they may be at risk, and we have to do this because it's what a civilization does. And so, again, I advise the law students that we will work through the issues of employment and bar admission and all those things because we can, but we need to do these things because we must.
That's the end of this special. Thank you for joining us. Again, if you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by myself. For Lori Walsh and Chris Loffrey, thanks for listening.